And hello, and welcome to Small Blue Planet. This may not sound like it, but this is Cheryl Morgan. If you're having difficulty with my voice, it's because I've not been terribly well recently, and 2 days ago I had no voice at all. But it's been getting better slowly, and with any luck, our fabulous producer, Karen Burnham, will be able to do amazing technical tricks with it so that you can hear me when this finally goes live. But of course, you're not here to listen to me, you're here to listen to our guests. And this month, we are delighted to be joined by a couple of guests from Israel. We have with us Gili Bar-Hillel and Didi Chanok. And rather than me carry on talking, why don't I get them to introduce themselves? Gili, hello.
Which one of us should start? Me?
You, Gili.
So I'm mostly a translator and a little bit of a publisher, and my specialty are YA and children's books. And I've translated a variety of great books, starting with the Harry Potter books and continuing with some classics like Peter Pan and The Wizard of Oz. So I do both contemporary and classic children's and YA, mostly. But I don't write. I'm not an author. And that's it. Didi?
I, too, am a non-author, although I do write. I translate. I've been translating on and off for nearly 20 years. With a few dozens of books. I'm involved in Israeli fandom and in our various conventions and have been for years. I also edit the blog, edit and do most of the writing for the blog of Graph Publishing. And generally am involved in all sorts of ways in Israeli science fiction.
Okay, well, excuse me. Okay, well, the first thing that we tend to ask people on these podcasts is what the science fiction and fantasy community is like in their countries. I don't know a huge amount about Israel. I'm aware of ICON, but nothing else. Didi, you seem to be a bit of an expert in the subject, so why don't you give us a quick guided tour of the Israeli community?
Well, the major organization in the Israeli community for the past few years has been the Israeli Society for Science Fiction and Fantasy, which is one of the organizations responsible for ICON. Other organizations that have been involved over the years are the Star Trek fan club and the Tolkien fan society and the role-playing society. The Science Fiction Society has been something of a constant. ICON is our biggest annual con. A couple of years ago, it split up into two cons, which competed, and both called themselves ICON, and that was a little confusing. But as of the coming conventions, one will be called ICON, the other one will be called Utopia, and is more of a film festival. But not just a film festival. We also have Olamot, which is a con that takes place during Passover. Olamot is Hebrew for worlds. We have Me'orot, which is a con that takes place at the winter. Me'orot means lights. And we have Bidyon, which means fiction, which is a more academic type con, started off as a little bit of a reader con type thing. And that takes place during National Book Week in June. So those are our cons.
Where do these conventions take place? I know that quite a few are in Tel Aviv, but are there other places around the country with the centers of fandom?
Me'orot takes place in Jerusalem. There are many small fanish groups or communities, especially certainly in universities, like in Be'er Sheva. But Tel Aviv is the hub. It's where the big conventions are, It's where people are used to going to places because Israel is small and Tel Aviv is kind of in the middle.
Yeah. Gilly, you've traveled a bit. I met you at a conference in Bristol. How does what happens in Israel compare to what you've seen in other countries?
I think the Israeli convention scene is really quite young compared to what I've seen in other places. Lots and lots of 20-somethings and teenagers and very few old-timers. There aren't, I don't see people who have been doing this for decades. And that means also, I think it's partly the reason for the popularity of the YA books. For if you ask me which books are popular in Israel, I think the YA books are doing really, really well because we have a young readership. And a lot of TV fans, Joss Whedon fans, Doctor Who fans. The fandom is young, and it's not just about books. It's genre, you know, all multimedia genre.
I guess that might relate to this question of the age of Israel as a country as well, which I know is something that I'd like to come back to later, but I think I just cut Didi off then, so please carry on, Didi.
I was going to say, we certainly don't have a lot of old-timers who've been doing it for a long time, mostly because our convention scene isn't that old. We've had cons since, well, we've had cons in the past, but few and far between, and we've had annual cons since 97. That's not a long time in European or American standards.
Absolutely not, no.
So you see occasional faces like Immanuel Lotem, who translated Tolkien, and he's sort of the representative of his generation, and really he brings the age average up. But there are very few of that age group around, and this also means the whole convention scene is a lot about socializing and just being together with a geek group, I think.
Yeah, I think it's also a size issue. Israel is a very small country, and doing a bunch of different cons for different things doesn't really make a lot of sense. So when we're doing ICON, it's everything. It's the media con, it's the literary con, it's the social con, it's the role-playing con, it's all
the
those things.
Con, it's the Harry Potter con. You have all these groups coming together. And there's also a lot of fan activity, productions, filking, I guess.
There's
filking.
So, do we have any fanzines or fiction magazines or anything like that in Israel?
The society publishes an annual book called Hayoye, which is Once Upon a Future, is how it is translated. And that's a book of stories. We've had historically a few magazines. When Gilly and I were kids, there was Fantasia 2000, which was mostly translated stuff, but a little bit of original fiction. And we have Olamot Baspamia, which is another less regularly published magazine, which is a mix of translated and original.
Publishers, I'm very familiar with Graf, obviously, because Rani Graf is a frequent visitor to conventions outside of Israel. Didi, you work for them. So can you tell us a bit about their output?
I would say it's been a little bit irregular in recent years. It's a mix of science fiction and fantasy, YA and adult, some non-genre stuff. It's really a personal taste filter rather than a specific genre filter. I've also translated for other publishers, so I can talk to those as well. Gilly has as well, so she can too. Gilly, go ahead.
I think the publishers producing genre fiction right now in Israel there are some small publishing houses that tend to specialize in that. They will do maybe 5 books a year, tops, maybe a little more. And these are publishers like Kidmat Eden. Opus used to be huge, and I think they've kind of scaled down as well. And alongside them, the major publishers in Israel.
You should also mention Yaniv, which is fairly new, sure. but is outputting significantly.
That's true, and that's also a one person publishing venture. That's really one person's personal taste. So there are a few of these small publishing houses that are just one person who decides to invest and put all of their heart and soul and money into publishing science fiction. And then the major publishing houses in Israel, some of them had a history of publishing science fiction and fantasy, but none of them are really doing it systematically right now. There are no ongoing science fiction and fantasy series at the major publishers right now in the past couple of years. And I think the entire publishing branch in Israel is in a bit of a crisis and is focusing mostly on bestsellers. And I think that the perception is that science fiction and fantasy is a limited audience. There's a cap to the audience, and these aren't going to be the major bestsellers. So most of the publishers are afraid of investing in that.
What about ebooks? Does the fact that you're producing in Hebrew create a problem for producing ebooks?
It actually does. Only very recently did someone build a workaround that allows Hebrew to be read on a Kindle. And not all the devices support Hebrew because Hebrew is right to left, not left to right. It creates technical problems that are not insurmountable, but there's not enough of an economic sort of motivation for people to invest in that. And ebooks haven't really picked up. Yeah, sorry?
Yeah, I was about to say, our biggest problem, I would say, is the lack of any working ecosystem for ebooks. There's been attempts, but they've been deeply flawed. I'm also a tech journalist, so I've covered that on that end as well. And at some point, I think Amazon is just going to step in because they do that everywhere and because they've already fixed the RTL problem. And when they do, the underbelly of the Israeli market is extremely vulnerable to them. So I think they'll do quite well.
Yeah, that figures. They've been opening new stores at quite a rate these days. So I'm sure that they'll have their eyes on you guys.
We're all waiting for a big change to happen because, as I said, it's the entire publishing industry that's in a bit of a crisis right now. Not just the science fiction and fantasy. The Israeli market is dominated by two major chains. I think more than 80% of books are sold in these two chains, and they've been having price wars with each other, driving the prices of books down at the expense of the publishers. And a lot of independent stores have closed, and a lot of small publishers have closed down. I know this is sort of a global thing. It's not just happening in Israel, but it seems to be quite extreme in Israel. And we're all waiting for some major change to happen so that the industry can survive.
I was going to say that you're quite lucky still having two chains. In the US and the UK, we've only really got one each. So
I'm not sure that is lucky because they seem to be mostly bent on driving prices down to run each other out of business. I'm not sure it's much better.
And they both might succeed.
Yeah, it doesn't help here because, of course, we have the supermarket chains competing with the bookstore chains. And that means that all of the best sellers are available for ridiculously low prices in the supermarkets. So anyway, yeah, but solving the publishing industry is not our problem today. I guess because Israel is a fairly small country, that if somebody wants to make a living as a writer, they're going to need to sell overseas. Is that correct?
Except for a very, very small select number of writers, yes. Absolutely.
So that brings us then on to writers from Israel who are available in English. And the first name that has to come to mind is Lavi Tittar. But some of our listeners are probably wondering why Lavi isn't on this podcast. Partly, of course, that's because he doesn't live in Israel these days. He's based mainly in London. And partly it's because we're going to have to talk about him. But if he was on this podcast, I might not tell him quite how good he is. But really, I've been following Lavi's career for some time. I reviewed some of his work way back when I was doing Emerald City. And I was completely blown away by Osama. I thought it was an amazing book. And I was so glad that it won the World Fantasy Award. What effect has that had in Israel?
None whatsoever. Lavi is an interesting case because I definitely think of him as an Israeli writer, even though he hasn't lived in Israel for a long time, and he also has a South African part of his identity. But he writes in English, and his books have been published in English and have not yet really been published in Hebrew. So he's not very well known here at all, which is sad, and I hope that changes.
Yeah, he's known in the Spanish community because he has published stories in Hebrew, and he's published a book with Nirya Neve in Hebrew, but he is not known in the wider literary community at all.
Well, that's very sad. You guys should talk him up a bit. I'm looking forward to getting hold of his new book, actually, which I gather has just come out from PS Publishing. Anybody read it yet?
The novella, I have not yet, but it's on my list.
I have not read it yet, but I think Gary Wolf reviews it for Locus this month. Just in case anyone's curious, they can get Locus online.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to read the current issue yet, because I've been too busy doing other things. I'm sorry.
we'll forgive you.
Thank you very much. Okay.
So again, it's an interesting case because definitely I would love to boast that we have such a wonderful Israeli author, but he's not known here. It's paradoxical, and I think that that's part of the problem. It's such a small reading community in Israel. That if you write in Hebrew, you're very limited as to the audience that you can reach. And if you write in English, then you're sort of losing your home audience.
Yeah, I can see how that's a problem. And indeed, it's a problem for many other countries as well. Lavi, of course, has been doing a good job in publicizing writers from all over the world, including some from Israel, and the two anthologies of world science fiction that he did for Apex include a number of Israeli writers. Didi mentioned Yerna Neve, who also has co-written a book with Lavi. So would somebody like to tell me about him?
Actually, most of what I know about Nirya Neve is personal. I know him in person as a person, and I have to admit that I haven't read much of his work. Again, it's not sort of mainstream writing here in Israel. Another one, though, of Lavi's friends whom I very much admire and who has been doing well as a mainstream author in Israel is Shimon Adaf. And I believe that some of Shimon Adaf's books are not yet available in English, but the rights have been purchased and will be translated. And Shimon walks that line between writing genre fiction and writing the kind of fiction that we all know is really fantasy, but gets sold as mainstream fiction and gets reviewed properly, and he just won a very prestigious award for his writing So it's sort of like a secret between genre lovers that Shimonadov secretly writes genre, but he's known simply as a mainstream author here.
He's by no means the only one that does that. In the second Apex book, there's a story by Gail Harriven, The Slows, and that was originally published in The New Yorker.
And she's another excellent example of that. Gail Harriven is, I don't think in Israel, considered a science fiction writer. But, of course, that story is pure science fiction.
Absolutely, yes.
Gail has a collection of what are essentially science fiction stories, and has appeared in Icon. While both Gail and Shimon tend to be marketed to a larger audience, neither one will deny their love and connection to genre.
Somebody else who's in the same category is Edgar Keret. There was an interview with him that I bought for Clark's World a couple of years ago, in which he said that Hugo was the first literary award that he'd become familiar with, and he was really hoping that he might be up for one day.
And again, Edgar is a very important author in mainstream Israeli literature. He's considered the voice of a generation and someone who sort of revolutionized the way stories are written, in that his language is I guess what we would call sparse language. It's no longer this very literary, overblown, flowery prose, but he really sort of streamlines his language and tells a story that's plot-oriented. He's a master of the short story with very interesting twists. And again, genre readers will recognize that a lot of his writing sits very well in the genre, but he's not considered a genre author in Israel. And I think if he were, he might be stigmatized and not be doing as well as he's been doing.
Well, I think we all have that problem. Just about every country I visit, they say that they have that problem.
But we have had books published that are very clearly science fiction and fantasy. Asafa Sheli's book, Simantov, is a really good fantasy book. Asaf Gavon's book, Hydromania, which, while hasn't been translated to English, has been translated into several European countries. Asaf Gavon actually does really well in Germany and in a few other countries.
Herzl Amar, Yoav
Avniv,
who wrote an alternate history of Israel. If the country had, as per one of the historic suggestions, been formed in Uganda instead of in this this geographic location. An alternate history is clearly genre. So yes, and there have been some successful, relatively successful genre novels.
Yeah, although I wouldn't say Yoav Avni is marketed as genre, but he has won the Geffen Award, which is our version of the Hugo.
Well, that's good to know that your genre community is recognizing people for what they do, regardless of how they're marketed.
Because the original output is really not that big, we would not have candidates for the category if we didn't. We would not be able to fill it up, certainly in the novel. We would in the short stories because of the various Spanish publications.
They're very prolific, actually, with the short stories. There's a lot of action happening with short stories. Again, this booklet that comes out every year with Icon of Tales of the Future, Once Upon a Future, is getting more and more interesting. But I am still yearning for good novels, for good fantasy novels that don't hide their identity, and I believe it will happen. I do think that's developing, but I think that part of the problem is that some of the fiction that's written that comes out of the fan community is really very derivative, and copies, I think, a lot of American cliches, and you see that even sometimes in the choice of names of characters. They're clearly not Israeli names. They're clearly not Hebrew names. It's as if you're writing genre, you have to set it in Europe land or in America land, and looking for that real Israeli voice. It there are glimpses of it, but I haven't really seen that happen yet.
I would say Asafa Sheri's Siman Tov is that.
Definitely. Asaf is an example of a glimpse. And I would love for Asaf to continue writing the kind of things that he's written, because it's great.
I would also like to mention an author who has come from Israeli fandom in the more traditional American way, and has published a collection and a novel, and it has kickstarted a sequel to the novel. And that's Vera Tochterman, who's written an Israeli vampire novel called Dam Kachol, which means blue blood.
Vera is another one of those exceptions to the rules. And Israel being such a small country, Vera is into everything. I mean, Vera wrote short stories, and she wrote her vampire novel, which is about to be followed by a sequel. She's also a translator, and she's also translated a lot. And she's also very just active in the online community. And she's sort of everywhere. We need more Verids.
The other person whose name is on my list because he was in one of Lavi's anthologies is Guy Hasson. What can you tell me about him?
Guy is another person who writes in English. He's a writer and a screenwriter. An author and a screenwriter, and his fiction is written, I think, exclusively in English. And some of it has been translated and published here, and he lives here, unlike Levine, whose national identity is a little unclear at times. Guy is certainly an Israeli, but I think he's possibly a little hampered as far as success in the country goes because he doesn't write in the language.
Okay. So we talked a lot about Israeli writers, and we've also talked a little bit about the classic writers that you'll get translated everywhere. Are there any authors that are popular in Israel that are perhaps more popular there relatively than they are in other countries? And you know, are people likely to get published in Israel or translated into Hebrew more if they are Jewish people?
The answer to the second question is no. People are not more likely to be translated if they're Jewish. There's even, I think, something of, I don't know if it's a disconnect or maybe I think things that are seen as being overly Jewish will probably not go over very well here. As to authors who are popular in Israel and not necessarily all over the world, first of all, Israel has, I think, a closer connection to European authors. So definitely in the fields of children's literature, kids of my generation grew up reading authors like Erich Kästner and Astrid Lindgren and Tove Jansson, who are not that well-known in the United States, at least. And also British authors like Enid Blyton were huge classic authors. But I think it's in the thing, even what's being published for kids today tends to be more and more and more American. So we're losing a bit of that European connection that we used to have. Didi, any ideas on adult authors?
Apart from really, you know, the big names, you know, Herbert is big, Tolkien is big, Douglas Adams, all of these are obvious. Robert Charles Wilson has done really well. Carol Berg has done really well. I think, though, that has a... Oh, Scott Card has done really well.
Neil Gaiman, again, that's more of an obvious one. I think it also has a lot to do with the publisher, because there's books that I've published for when I was an editor at Opus, or later when I was an editor at Modan, that I think would have done a lot better had they been produced with the level of investment and marketed at the level that Graf does. Bob Wilson and Carol Berg were published by Graf and got that level of promotion, and that's been
including that they were brought
boost.
as guests of honor to ICON, so they actually came to Israel, and Carol Berg I think made a lot of friends while she was here in Israel. People are very, very happy to have the authors come. It's not always easy to get authors from other countries to come visit Israel and come be guests of honors at the conventions. So people get very excited, and then they go out and seek her books. And of course, her books are wonderful. So I think she's a great example. And I take a lot of credit for making Dana Wynne Jones popular here. Sorry.
Carol has sold well before being brought over, which was a reason why she was, you know, brought over. So I'm sure it's helped, but a certain level of sales has been established that was significantly higher than what I would have gotten as Opus for people like Steve Bruce and David Brin, who are quite successful. Lois McMaster Bujold, these are all authors I published either at Modan or at Opus who did not do as well as they could. And I think the publisher had a lot to do with that.
There's definitely a sense of, I think, community loyalty to certain publishers. Certain publishers are seen as being devoted to the community, and then they get a lot of credit for that and a lot of trust in their selections. And a publisher like Modan, who sometimes does science fiction and sometimes doesn't, and doesn't really, you know, contribute to the conventions, and I think they get a lot less credit than a publisher like Graf, who always has a presence, who always contributes to conventions, who's always looking for a way to connect with the community.
I also think it's just good marketing. Modan does not market their science fiction as they do, or didn't when I was an editor there, as they do their bestsellers. You would not find the word science fiction on a Stephen King novel that they published, even if it's as science fiction-y as can be.
That it all goes together. It all works together, I think.
Yeah.
Even though the things that have been really successful, even for Graf, the most successful titles are the ones that find an audience outside of the science fiction and fantasy community, like Rick Riordan's Percy Jackson books that just, you know, they became smash hits, and it has nothing to do with their being science fiction or fantasy. They found a readership outside of that.
Yeah, YA really does well. Susan Collins' books have done incredibly well. So, yeah.
I would think there'd be plenty of people queuing up to have their books translated. I remember many years ago when the whole game book thing first started, and many of my friends, including Mark Gascoigne, were writing these things, that the really exciting thing was to get your book translated into Hebrew, because, you know, then you got this thing and it was all Hebrew and it was read in a different direction and it was amazing. And everybody got really excited about that. I'm sure that authors feel that way as well today.
The problem is that translation is really expensive, and these books very, very seldom break even. So you really need to find someone who just absolutely does it for the love of it, who believes so strongly in a book that they're willing to invest in it even if they don't make their investment back. And that's how you get all these publishers who will just publish what they love, which is not necessarily the most contemporary stuff. It's not necessarily cutting edge. It's not necessarily representative of anything. It's not necessarily the best stuff. It's just what a particular person absolutely loves and is willing to stand behind.
Well, and one of the purposes of this podcast is to tell you translators how much we love you for all the wonderful work that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we should move on a little bit. And Gilly sent me a link to a fascinating article by Abigail Nussbaum, which touches on a whole range of subjects. There are a few things that I want to highlight from it. The first one was the statement that she made that it could be seen that Israel was founded on the basis of a piece of science fiction.
Absolutely. That's not even a highly disputed statement. Herzl wrote a science fiction book, and then it became true.
He imagined a state that was an all-Jewish state, and when he wrote that, that was completely fantastical. I mean, his ideas that, unfortunately for us, have become a reality. A state in which everyone is Jewish, not only the policemen, but also the burglars, they're also Jewish. Yep, that's our reality.
Yeah, although I think he imagined a more honest system than we have, but it's not a political podcast, so I won't go into that.
Well, that's one of the problems with utopias, isn't it? They never quite turn out the way that the authors thought they would.
No, they never do.
And part of forging the identity in this new country also involved turning our backs on a lot of our roots and a lot of our connections, which means that Israeli literature developed in a very different direction than what we would think of as Jewish literature. And there are I think that authors who instead of coming to Palestine immigrated to America and continued writing in Yiddish ended up coming up with a completely different literature than what was formed here, and one that's a lot more connected to Jewish roots than what's being written in Israel. And perhaps part of the artificiality of what I was saying about derivative works being written here is that we've lost our roots. We no longer have our connection to Jewish writing. And maybe that's what makes particular authors that we've already mentioned, like Asaf Asheri and Shimon Adaf, who grew up religious, who grew up with a lot of the religious traditions, but later became secular. So they can reintroduce a lot of the Jewish mysticism into their works,
We should also mention Sarah Blau, who didn't just grow up religious, is still religious in her own extremely unique way, and has also written a very Jewish fantasy novel called Yetzer Levadama about the golem.
A young woman who creates a golem really to satisfy her sexual needs. And it has a lot of very personal stuff, personal demons in there, as well as the Holocaust and all of the Jewishness and the Israeliness, all mixed up. So that's some very powerful writing, and I think that maybe people like me who grew up completely secular are missing out on the Jewish mysticism aspect of things.
The book that Nussbaum is reviewing in this article is an academic work about the state of fantastic fiction in Israel. I gather that a lot of people have some issues with it, which I don't think we've really got time to go into here, but the essential thrust of it, as I understand it, is that the authors felt that Israel wasn't producing much in the way of fantastic fiction because the people of Israel were far too busy trying to build a country. Is that a fair characterization?
I would not say that's completely fair. I think that there was, and I think that's the message that the book is, that many of the writers in the book are trying to convey, an intentional disconnect from the fantastic, because it was considered trivial. when you were trying to build a nation. I think it's not so much we were too busy, but it was, you know, if you're not writing something that is important or about this thing that we're building here, then you probably shouldn't be writing that. And that's a mindset that's really only started to change in recent years, largely due to a couple of key people becoming editors of original fiction at large publishing houses, one of which being Shimon Adaf, and another is our good friend Noah Mannheim, who's the lead editor, the senior editor at Zmura Bitan, who's Israel's Kineret Zmura Bitan, which is the biggest publishing house in Israel.
I feel it very strongly in children's literature that there is a gap of several decades where everything produced in Israel, and I, the more I research it, the more I realize that this was deliberate, was hyper-realist and even often socialist, and was all about real people right now and what they're doing and why it's important. And fantasy was always sort of marginalized, even more than in the rest of the world. It was seen as weird. It was seen as sort of deviant.
Inappropriate. Although it's, we should mention Lizachi.
Right. There were very, very few authors who did manage to stick in some fantasy works, and one of them is the poet Lizachi, who really writes. Who writes very intriguing stuff that is definitely fantastic, but also quite often hard to understand because it's sort of dreamlike. But there's when I look at what's being produced for kids today, that legacy of decades of writing socialist works, of writing works about building the country, that sort of shifted into writing these psychological help sort of work. It's like everything that's written for kids has to have a purpose and has to have a use. And it's only very, very recently that we've seen the beginnings of what I consider true fantasy writing that doesn't have these goals or purposes. It's not a tool. It's just there to be enjoyed.
Well, I'd like to reassure you that it's nothing to do specifically with being Jewish, because an awful lot of what you're saying is very familiar to me from having grown up in a Methodist household. My father wasn't Methodist, but my mother's family were deeply Methodist. My mother's father was a lay preacher and so on. And all of this that you're saying is very, very familiar to me, the whole thing that you know, we have a purpose in life and we shouldn't waste our time on frivolous fiction.
Yes, except this was on a more of a national scale.
Well, you know, it was a national scale in the UK not that long ago. It's just that you've gone through it rather more recently than we have. And it sounds that from what you're saying of all the young people going to conventions that you're growing out of it as well.
I love frivolous fiction, and I'm very much looking forward to some of these often very, very enthusiastic young people starting to write their own stuff and do less copying and more inventing. And I think things are changing. I'm very optimistic about what we will be seeing in future years.
Okay, well, I just want to move on now to the issue of translation. And the final point to bring out in this one's essay, and I think the most interesting one that she brings up, is the question of Hebrew as a language. And she's quoting here from an essay by Sela Shapiro, who's a translator, worked on Philip Pullman and George Martin.
Yeah, and Sela Shapiro, yes.
Yeah. And the message here is that during most of recent history, Hebrew was primarily a religious language, so it would have been used for religious ceremonies, but Jewish people in their day-to-day lives would have spoken the language of whatever country that they were living in. And then when the State of Israel was founded and Hebrew became the official language, Hebrew then had a duty as a working day-to-day language as well. And because it hadn't been used in that way for a long time, it lacked the vocabulary that other languages had developed during that period. And there's some talk, for example, of trying to translate fantasy when you've never gone through a stage of having a word for arquebus or stiletto or manservant or various fantastic creatures and such. Now, you're both translators, so I'm just trying to remember the... There's a term that Nussbaum used, which I think is a quote from the book, of semantic voids. Do either of you have any opinion on this?
These are very valid points. Israel was really reinvented as a language about a century ago, and for many years it was just a holy tongue that didn't have native speakers, that wasn't used daily. It was used only in religious ceremonies. It was preserved, I guess, but it wasn't alive. And what we've seen is very rapid development of Hebrew, but then there are all these gaps. There are words for telephones and television and faxes and all these modern appliances, but there aren't necessarily words. I remember an example. I had to translate a book on ice skating that had different terms from the field of ice skating that were in use in the 1940s. So there we have Israeli ice skaters nowadays, but we didn't have Israeli ice skaters in the 1940s, and there aren't different terms for ice skating in the 1940s. And in fantasy, this is often felt, because fantasy often takes place in these periods of time where people didn't speak Hebrew. And you want a term that's not only comprehensible, but that sounds old-fashioned and that sounds like something archaic, and that doesn't always necessarily exist.
Yeah, it's particularly annoying when it comes to pieces of armor, because in English you have a different word for every one of them, and in Hebrew, you're right, essentially, the only way to make it really understandable is to write chest armor, shin armor, shoulder armor, because we don't have the words for all the bits. It's occasionally very frustrating, but it's not, you know, it's not a killer issue. It's not something that any of us hasn't dealt with and solved in various ways in various books.
It also can be quite fun, because you can get quite inventive and no one will be able to tell you that you're wrong if you make up your own terms.
Well, it's good to have a language where people don't object to you making up terms.
Oh, people always...
Well, we have the internet.
Oh, that's true, yes. Yes, there's always somebody out there who will object. Okay, so let me turn the question on its head now. Are there things that you can write in Hebrew that are very difficult to translate into English because English doesn't have a word for it?
I think there definitely Hebrew has possibilities of for wordplay that don't exist in English because of the way that words are formed in Hebrew. Word formation in Hebrew and in other Semitic languages involves taking a root, a three-letter root, and sticking it into different structures. Words that have some kind of semantic connection will often have the same root, and you might have the same root for my son's name. My son is called Haggai, and Haggai has to do with cycles, with things that are cyclical. So it also is related to the word dial and to circling, but it's also related to holidays, because holidays are seasonal and they cycle and they come around once a year. And so you can have words So the idea that a telephone dial is like a holiday is sort of natural in Hebrew, because you see the connection and then you think about why do these words sound similar. And I think that that doesn't happen in English. You don't have these kinds of connections between words that allow you to play around with meanings and with connections. And it's quite lovely. It's one of my favorite parts about Hebrew. And it also allows me as a translator to make up words that are completely new and have never used before, but are immediately recognizable and understandable.
Sorry, Didi, go on.
I was going to say, apart from that, and another issue is where such connections do exist in English, they're not necessarily the same connections. And the other issue is that Hebrew is a gendered language, by which I mean everything has a gender. And if you're referring to it, you do it with that gender. Every object is, some objects are both male and female, and you can refer to them as both, but most objects and things are either male or female.
Yeah, we encountered that with our French friends last month. Just coming back to what Gilly said, I'm sort of familiar with the idea of the word roots from Kabbalistic magic, but it hadn't quite occurred to me the possibilities for literary tricks there. And I'm trying to work out if there's some way of doing that sort of thing in English, maybe with Latin roots of languages or something like that. Latin roots of words, rather, not languages.
I think nothing in translation is ever completely impossible, but it will always be a little bit different. There will always be some kind of shift, and Hebrew blends itself in a much more friendly and natural manner to these kinds of connections than English does. And I think Hebrew also likes rhymes more than English does, and that's again in children's literature. You see a lot of children's books that are written in rhymes. And I sometimes wonder if people who try to translate them into rhymes are in English really understand that this is not in the same way part of the English literary tradition. So everything is possible for translators if you're creative enough, but it will always involve compromise, will always involve shifting something, and is always kind of personal. Different translators will find different solutions.
Hmm. One question I had, Cheryl, if you don't mind me interjecting, for Gilly, is do you find a big difference in translating children's books versus adult, adult works or works meant for adults? You mentioned the rhyming aspect, and I was wondering, so often children's books are supposed to have, quote unquote, simpler language, but I wonder if that might almost be harder to translate.
I think that one of the major differences is that people have a lot more hang-ups about children's literature and a lot more expectations. They really do. And a lot more expectations that children's literature has to fill a purpose. It has to be safe. It cannot corrupt our children. So you get a lot of discussions about children's literature that would be ludicrous if you were to examine every adult book that you read in the same light. And I definitely had some of these problems when I was translating the Harry Potter books. I saw often the generational gap between people of a generation who expected the literature to be beneficial and to be educational, and therefore I have to make language choices that are more conservative towards Hebrew and less putting in the foreign sounding words and foreign sounding names. Whereas younger readers, just for example, names used to be translated when works of fiction were translated. So very early translations, even of Romeo and Juliet, an early translation was Ram and Yael. Romeo became Ram, Juliet became Yael. These are very Canaanite-sounding names and kind of ridiculous. but there's an expectation that children need to be taught Hebrew, so the books need to be, the Hebrew in the books needs to be even possibly better than the English in the English books. Whereas younger readers nowadays are a lot more open to foreign influences and get kind of upset when they feel that things have been tampered for their own good. And were upset with me for translating even things like the Death Eaters that I thought that had a perfectly good translation into Hebrew, but they wanted me to leave it Death Eaters so that you heard the English in it. These kinds of discussions, I think, wouldn't ever come up, well, a lot less for adult literature than they do for kids' literature.
I'm now wondering whether anybody's tried to translate Margot Lanigan.
No, not that I know.
No, the answer to your question is no.
But yeah, but again, I know I loved Margot's Tender Morsels as a reader, and as a publisher, I wouldn't touch it in Israel because it would be so hard to sell, and it would start such a circus, and I would have to be defending it constantly. I'm not sure we're ready for that. I think we're too conservative, maybe.
That's kind of sad, but hopefully things will move on.
Yeah, there's always an evolution, so we can certainly hope to reach a place where that wouldn't be as much of an issue as it would be now.
Anybody got anything else that they want to talk about?
I think that one of the characteristics of readers in Israel is that a lot of them know English, which makes publishing sometimes strange, because many of the more sophisticated readers just don't even wait for translations. So who are we actually translating for? Because a large percentage of the people who are very interested in genre, who do want to follow, who do want to read everything, simply have English that's good enough to allow them to read the books in English. Maybe that's another reason for the success or for focusing on books for younger readers, because you can get people who still appreciate the translation, who still need the translation.
And I guess also, yeah, if there are things that you can do in Hebrew that you perhaps can't do in other languages, there might be benefit in translating there. Although, of course, if there are things not in the original, you'd be adding it, which could be controversial.
Yeah. There's always an audience for translated works, but it is diminished. Especially when it comes to the serious fans. I became proficient in English because when I turned 15 or so, I ran out of books that have been translated. So I started reading books in English. It certainly had an impact, but there's a market, but you have to reach beyond the diehards, many of whom do have very, very, very good English.
Alrighty. Well, hopefully there will continue to be a market for books in Hebrew, because one of the reasons we do these podcasts is to celebrate the fact that there are many languages around the world other than English, and they all have interesting features to them. So we want people to carry on writing fiction in those languages. So I guess I'm now feeling very guilty about our cultural imperialism here.
As well you should.
Yeah.
Come back and visit us in a few years, and I hope we'll have more exciting books to tell you about, to share with you.
I certainly hope so. And if we're still going in 2 years, I would be absolutely delighted to come back.
It's a date, then.
Excellent. Perhaps I shall come to ICOM one day.
Oh,
that would be delightful.
And you'd not only everybody would love to have you. I think that one of the experiences that all of the authors who have come to ICON and been our guests of honor have reported is that they really are embraced by the community. When people do come to visit us, we're very, very happy to have them.
Yeah, I've been in charge of guest of honor liaison for ICON for many of the years we've had ICON, and we've had some very, very happy authors leave the country. If you talk to anyone from Tim Powers, Carol Berg, Steve Bruce, Guy Kay, Neil Gaiman, any of these people will tell you that they had a very good time.
All right. And as we've been going for about an hour now, that sounds like an excellent point on which to end the podcast. So unless anybody has anything else they're burning to say, I think we can call that a wrap.
Sure.
That's it. That's
In which case, thank you very much, Gilly and Dee Dee. That was a fascinating little tour of Israel we had. Hopefully everybody else has enjoyed listening to it as well. And please do come and join us again next month when we'll be off to the Philippines.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to listening to your podcast.